It's a great pleasure and a tremendous privilege to welcome all of you to what promises to be an extraordinary set of conversations. On behalf of the Social Science Research Council, I'd like to thank both Stony Brook University and especially our host today, NYU's Institute for Public Knowledge, for their central support of this major event. The size of the audience in front of us and the buzz of excitement we've seen in the run-up to this gathering, it seems to me, attest not only to the academic provenance, public stature, and remarkable intellectual gifts of our four speakers, but also to the timeliness and substantial importance of our topic today. We gather in the midst of a widespread resurgence of interest in the public importance of religion, both within the university and beyond. At the same time, there's been an increasing acknowledgement that the terms in which discussions of religion, secularism, and public life have thus far been carried out are inadequate to the task. The very categories of the religious and the secular, and of secularism and religion, are today being revisited and reconsidered, reworked and rethought. Such rethinking, we believe, represents a significant moment of opportunity. With this in mind, we're honored and delighted to have Judith Butler, Jürgen Habermas, Charles Taylor, and Cornel West with us this afternoon. Each of our speakers is a highly respected scholar and a well-known public intellectual. Each is a philosopher, though not one has been contained by the academic discipline of philosophy. Each has a distinctive intellectual style, a wide interdisciplinary reach, and a strong commitment to public engagement. I will not attempt to introduce them in detail now, since my colleagues will do so at the outset of our first two panels. And in a very real sense, all four individuals are people who, for many of you, will need no introduction. We'll begin with two opening panels split by an intermission, and in our third session, we'll bring together all four speakers for a brief concluding discussion. While we won't be taking direct questions or comments from the floor, we want to encourage all of you to continue the conversation following today's exchange by adding your voice to the collective online discussion we'll be hosting at the Imminent Frame, the SSRC's interdisciplinary blog on secularism, religion, and the public sphere. I'll now turn things over to Craig Calhoun, who will introduce our first two speakers and moderate our opening panel. A major scholar and a well-known theorist in his own right, Calhoun is University Professor of Social Science at NYU, Director of the University's Institute for Public Knowledge, and current President of the Social Science Research Council. He's long been engaged with the work of both Habermas and Taylor. In addition to numerous books and articles, he is editor or co-editor of several collections, including an important volume on Habermas and the public sphere, published in the early 1990s, and a new volume on Charles Taylor entitled Varieties of Secularism in a Secular Age, forthcoming with Harvard University Press. Greg?
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Let me restate the welcome. Let me restate the thanks to all who made this conference possible, the sponsoring institutions, the SSRC, Stony Brook University, and NYU. And let me call attention to the remarkable and beautiful room at Cooper Union in which this discussion takes place. It is a room, as this is a podium, with a history that dates back to Abraham Lincoln's election campaigns and the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and has thus a special significance for thinking about the public sphere and about democracy, and is an extremely appropriate place in which to welcome our distinguished guests. It is a pleasure to introduce Jürgen Habermas and Charles Taylor, who are inspirations and teachers and friends of mine for many years. It is also a challenge. Like Judith Butler and Cornel West, who will speak in the next panel, both are extraordinarily famous, influential, and accomplished. They have written too many books for me to mention, but precisely because their work spans and integrates so many different academic fields, and indeed political and public concerns, brief orienting comments may be welcome, and praise never goes amiss. Neither Habermas nor Taylor is specifically a virtue philosopher, but both exemplify important, and I'm afraid not ubiquitous, virtues of contemporary intellectual life, honesty, courage, intellectual rigor, and commitment to the greater good. From his earliest writings in Germany after World War II, Jürgen Habermas questioned the idea that culture, politics, and philosophy could simply return to normal without critical interrogation and moral consideration of what had happened. But at the same time, he rejected simple continuity. Habermas called for renewal and recovery of what was valuable in the rich German philosophical tradition. He disturbed the consensus of silence with probing public questions, and yet at the same time, he restored faith in a variety of core values of the Enlightenment with sustained philosophical and sociological inquiry into the historical transformations of the public sphere, the potential for transformation of society by communicative action, and the nature of social life in an era of accelerating instrumental reason and technology. In his early work, Habermas emphasized the idea of knowledge-forming interests, and throughout his career, he has remained true to such basic and enduring interests as democracy, the refusal of forgetting, and the nurturing of human capacity to guide action and achieve solidarity by means of communication oriented to understanding. This is central to his current work on religion and secularism, and to our discussion today. The structural transformation of the public sphere was a landmark, and a landmark denied to monoglot English audiences for more than 15 years, but one which has influenced a huge outpouring of discussion in a new context of the contemporary transformations of the public sphere. It is but one of literally tens, dozens of books of Habermas's work, which have had huge impacts in a variety of different contexts, both intellectual and political, from the 1960s and 70s crises through a series of changing circumstances since then, and opening up a variety of different themes, many of them concerned with the relationship between facts and norms. He has addressed the relationship between justification and application, the problems of moving beyond ethnic nationalism with new forms of inclusion and integration and new approaches to justice and solidarity. He's tackled a variety of basic questions about the very nature of being human, as well as about knowledge and the nature of society. And very prominently, he has explored the public significance of religion in essays collected in a pair of major recent books, and well beyond. And as he explores the ways in which religious and non-religious ideas may jointly inform public discourse, Habermas speaks simultaneously to questions of justice, knowledge, and solidarity. Also among the most influential of late 20th century philosophers, Charles Taylor has written on human agency, identity and the self, language, the limits of epistemology, interpretation and explanation in social science, ethics, democratic politics, and now the nature of secularism and a secular age. In an early book on explanation of behavior, Taylor charted some of the enduring interests that have run through his work. These include the limits of purely external causal theories of human action and understandings of the meaning of human society. Interpretations and the Sciences of Man pursues this in the context of methodology for social science, but Taylor has pursued it equally in a range of different philosophical works addressing and incorporating the work of Hegel, among others, in a wide intellectual history that he has reconstituted as a basis for contemporary understanding, in both critical and, if you will, positive works outlining approaches to understanding the contemporary world, and above all, in moving beyond a perniciously sharp distinction between knower and object of knowledge that has often distorted and narrowed the scope of understanding in human life. This is an important dimension of what Taylor has called the secular age. By this, he means not merely an end to or a marginalization of religious belief, as he says, a subtraction from some previous state, but a transformation in the way human subjects are embedded in broader frameworks of meaning. Taylor has addressed this theme not only in his magisterial book on a secular age, but in a range of works on the nature of self and society, the ethics of authenticity, the problems of multiculturalism and the politics of recognition. All of these considerations inform Taylor's explorations of modern social imaginaries, ways of thinking about the world and images of the world which are in some degree constitutive for the world, and it is this concern, as well as his lifelong questioning of the ways religious thought is compartmentalized, that led Taylor to write his recent monumental book, A Secular Age. Each of our speakers brings to the questions of religion in the public sphere and the nature of secularism an extraordinarily wide and deep command of the resources of Western intellectual history, a probing inquiry into the significance of these problems for contemporary public life, and a willingness to think beyond the established parameters of previous thought, even his own previous thought in each case. With no further ado, it's a pleasure to introduce first Jürgen Habermas, who will speak on the political, the rational sense of a questionable inheritance from political theology. With no further intervention from me, Charles Taylor will follow, speaking on why we need a radical redefinition of secularism, and then I will moderate a discussion between these two extraordinary intellectuals whom we have a pleasure to listen to today. Jürgen.
Yeah, I'm grateful to Craig Calhoun and Eduardo Mendieta to include me in this circle of distinguished speakers this afternoon and for offering me to stand at this podium. But I beg you in advance for your indulgence. I am not living in this country, at least not continuously. I am not sufficiently familiar with the conflicts on the public role of religion, so that I cannot speak here as a kind of intellectual and intervene in ongoing controversies. Therefore, you will have, I'm sorry, to listen to and to bear a rather dry academic presentation. Now, a couple of weeks ago, correspondents reported from Beijing that the imminent solar eclipse had aroused a certain anxiety within political circles over there. The communist regime appeared to be concerned about the superstitious associations that the event could have triggered in the province. According to an ancient Chinese tradition, such a constellation means that the celestial dock is swallowing the sun. Such that, and such a constellation then, since heaven is an important symbol for the divine order of cosmos, this disruption of the normal course of heavens was long interpreted as indicating some disorder in the ruling house. Now, this little report, some of you might have read also in the New York Times, doesn't bother it as it is, or it looks like a message from a sunken or buried world of political cosmology. However, when the American president interpreted a profound disruption of the normal course of history, such as the monstrous attack of 9/11, before a world public in concepts derived from a political theology, we, SES, to the Judeo-Christian tradition, could not dismiss the evocation of an axis of evil as a curiosity. Many people took Bush's statement in the speech on November 10, 2001, before the Assembly of the United Nations very seriously. History, he said, as an author who fills time and eternity with his purpose. We know that evil is real, but good will prevail against it. In both instances, a connection was made between politics and an order of things interpreted either in cosmological or in theological terms. From this perspective, political events are embedded in a comprehensive, in the broader sense, religious world order. Even Hegel, as you remember, still criticized the modern separation of politics and religion as a monstrous blunder of our times. Now, a century later, a decidedly less liberal Carl Schmitt celebrated the demise of this liberal achievement, separation of state and religion. He celebrated it in his political theology in the following words: "We have come to recognize that the political is the total." Das Ganze. In November 1933, a contemporary audience could not fail to pick up on the positive reference to Hitler's total state. The concept of the political alludes to an encompassing whole infused with religious connotations. Already a year earlier, Carl Schmitt had explained that the political is not just one subsystem alongside others, such as the economy, the family, education, or culture. It is rather linked to a transcendent power that secures the unity and integration of the community as a whole. And in his notes on this same notorious text, Carl Schmitt, on the conception of the political, Leo Strauss is also impressed by the dimension of the political that reaches into the religious and metaphysical dimensions. With this, Strauss is not thinking of a political theology concerning God's intervention in history, but rather of the truths of classical political philosophy. Plato and Aristotle had answered the questions to the just society, of the just society and the good life from the metaphysical perspective of a nature conceived in teleological terms. In this respect, Greek political philosophy, like Confucianism, for instance, shares with political theology the orientation to a dimension in which political processes are subordinated to a cosmic or divine nomos. For both Leo Strauss and Carl Schmitt, the political is the binding source for all authority and an inescapable fate. However, the era when philosophy could elevate itself above the sciences belongs to the past. Today, the social sciences lay claim to the political system as their subject matter. They deal with politics, that is, with the struggle for and the exercise of power and also with policies, that is, with the strategies pursued by the political actors in different political fields. Today, the political no longer seems to constitute a scientific topic alongside politics and policies. Why then bother with a concept that seems to retain a clear descriptive meaning only for the historian? The political at best designates a symbolic field in which the early civilizations first form an image of themselves, quite importantly. As a reminder, the concept of the political leads us back to the origins of state-organized societies, such as the ancient empires of, say, Mesopotamia or Egypt, in which social integration had been partly transferred from kinship structures to the hierarchical forms of royal bureaucracies. The emergent complex of law and political power gave rise to a totally new functional requirement, namely the legitimation of political authority. It is not a given that one person or a group of persons can make decisions that are collectively binding on all. Only by establishing a convincing connection of legal and political power with religious beliefs and practices could the rulers be assured that the people abide by the law. While the legal system is backed by the sanctioning power of the state, political authority in turn depends on the legitimizing force of a law perceived as sacred law. The monarch's judicial power and its sacred aura is owed to mythical narratives that now fuse the ruling dynasties with the divine. At the same time, old ritual practices became transformed into state rituals through which the society as a whole represents itself in the figure of the ruler. Hence, this symbolic dimension is a manifestation of that fusion of politics and religion to which the concept of the political refers. Now, the collectivity sees itself mirrored in the ruler's self-representation as a political community that intentionally, that means deliberately, achieves its social integration through the exercise of political power. In this political self-understanding of the polity, the locus of control shifts more to collective action for the first time in history. Certainly, we owe the first conceptions of the political only to the nomos doctrines of Israel, China, and Greece, and more generally to the metaphysical and religious worldviews that were emerging at the Axial Age. Once this transformation has taken place, the political ruler can no longer be perceived as a manifest embodiment of the divine, but only as its human representation. From now on, he, as a human person, is also subordinated to the nomos in the light of which all human action must be measured. Because the axial worldviews make both legitimation and the critique of political authority possible at the same time, the political in the ancient empires was marked by an ambivalent tension between religious and political powers, as you know. On the one hand, the state power pursued religious policies aimed at securing the consent of religious groups and institutions. On the other hand, religious beliefs preserved a moment of intangibility on account of their relevance for individual salvation. Though the religiously backed belief in legitimacy can well be manipulated and has been manipulated all the time, it is never totally at the disposition of politics. The precarious balance can be studied between the political power and the representatives of religious traditions providing legitimation. The precarious balance can be studied deep into the European Middle Ages in the relationship between the emperor and the pope. Now, the bold historical jump I just made hints at the extensive time span during which talk of the political kept a clear meaning. I cannot discuss the improbable constellation that made possible both the unique synthesis of theology and Greek metaphysics and the rise of Pauline Christianity to become the Roman state religion, which in turn called forth the political theology of Augustine. Only on the basis of these historical connections can we explain the concept of the political which Leo Strauss and Carl Schmitt were able to pick up and develop in quite different ways. Strauss took his orientation from Greek political philosophy, Schmitt from Augustine's political theology that had left deep traces in the political history of the Christian West. However, under the changed condition of the modern period, these two traditional conceptions of the political had lost their setting in life, as it were. To be sure, neither Strauss's nor Schmitt's treatment of these historical models, the Greek and the Christian one, can be described as naive. They both developed their conception through a critical encounter with the Leviathan of Hobbes, who already, of course, saw the emergence of the modern European system of sovereign states in the modern sense before his eyes. Whereas Leo Strauss remains convinced that the legitimating power of classical natural law can be restored in one way or the other, even in modernity, Carl Schmitt develops a new and provocative concept of the political based on motives of some reluctant modernism. He wants to preserve, in the modern context of secularized mass democracy, both the authoritarian kernel of sovereign power and its legitimizing relation to a Christian reading of sacred history. There's no need to go into the details of this clerico-fascist conception, because it is not the project itself Madhava is motivation that still deserves our interest. I think it directs our intention to a normative dimension of politics which remain essential for citizens of a liberal state too. In Schmitt's view, liberalism, of course, is a force that robs politics of its significance for society as a whole, on the one hand, through the emancipation of a functionally differentiated society from the overarching thing of medieval times, the overarching structure of a political frame, and on the other hand, by decoupling the state from a privatized religion that has lost its sting and therewith the important function of authorizing political power. That's behind the criticism of liberalism in Carl Schmitt. In view of these trends towards what Schmitt called the neutralization of politics, the constitutional revolutions at the end of the 18th century symbolize for Schmitt a catastrophic but at the same time irreversible caesura in world history. They ratify the secularization of state power as a consequence of the self-empowerment of democratic citizens. Liberal constitutions disperse the sovereignty once concentrated in the person of the ruler, and within the liberal states, the substance of sovereign power further on dissolves in the asset bath of continuing democratic law making. For Schmitt, it is not only the challenge of the confessional split and the fact of religious pluralism that calls for a secular state authority which is capable of keeping equal distance from any particular religion and of treating the claims of all religious community impartially. Even apart from that, the self-empowerment of citizens is in itself the blasphemic act that strips the legitimation of political power of its meta-social character, in other words, of its reference to the warranting force of a transcendent authority operating from beyond society. Even the Constitution emanates from the people, from the people's own resolve to ensure in a voluntary association of free and equal legal subjects that human dignity of each citizen enjoys the equal respect of all. Now, this break with the traditional pattern of legitimation raises, in fact, the question of whether the move towards justification of constitutional essentials in the secular terms of popular sovereignty and human rights close off the dimension of the political, thereby rendering the concept of the political with its religious connotations obsolete. Or does the locus of the political merely shifts from the level of the state to the democratic opinion and will formation in civil society? Against both Carl Schmitt and Leo Strauss, we might ask, why should the collective identity of a political community not find an impersonal embodiment in the normative dimension of a democratic constitution? And what would the revised conception of the political then mean for the relation between religion and politics in societies like ours. Carl Schmitt's resentment against liberalism is explained by the fact that he conceives both the secular character of state power and the democratic character of the Constitution as resulting from an atheist act of rebellion against God. The self, I mean, he had not the American, but the French Revolution, of course, before his eyes. The self-empowerment of men appears as manifestation of the power of the Antichrist. I think that a similar effect smolders even in the more inconspicuous impulse to save some public religious foundation for democracy and the rule of law, and that impulse might trigger deflationary accounts of the historical rupture between the meta-social legitimation of the past and a justification of constitutional principles within the limits of a reason common to all. This is, I suspect, also raising some questions between my friend Chuck and me tonight. Admittedly, there is a touch of paradox in the liberal constitution, which is at least partially designed for the purpose of granting citizens equal religious liberties, and yet defense of any particular religious influence on enforceable political decisions. The very same persons who are legally empowered to practice their religion and to lead a pious life are supposed to participate as citizens in providing the input into a democratic process, the output of which must be cleansed from any specifically religious contents. This paradox finds one response in a strictly laicist political culture like the French one. However, as long as religion remains a vital force within civil society, we are reminded of the fact that we must not confound the secularization of the state with that of civil society. Apart from feasibility, the secular constitution itself, I think, provides some normative reasons for why we must not cut off the influence of religion from the political public sphere. I cannot think of a better argument than the role that persons like Cornel West play in this country. John Rawls is the first political philosopher who systematically takes into account the relevance of religious doctrines and communities. For both, the founding of a secular constitution and the democratic process within such a secular frame. Rawls explains the meaning of the political which has shifted into civil society in terms of a political concept of justice and grounds principles of fair cooperation among free and equal citizens. That means, in contrast to the contrarian tradition, Rawls retains a certain role for religion even in the justification of a secular constitution. That is the story on the overlapping consensus. I would have liked to say something to that, because I think that Oz makes here an important argument, but an argument that finally doesn't really carry over into an important role of religion in the very justification of a secular constitution, but only in its stabilization. I mean, it's necessary in order to establish in a pluralist society. Now, the interaction with religion is even more importantly reflected in the public role that religion plays within the public sphere once such an overlapping consensus on constitutional essentials are reached. Rawls has stirred up a lively debate with his explanation of the proper use of public reason, which any liberal state must expect from religious and non-religious citizens alike. Now, in this debate, I have suggested that all citizens should be free to decide whether they want to use religious language in the public sphere. In this case, they have to accept, however, that the potential truth content of religious utterances must be translated into a generally accessible language before they can find its way onto the agenda of parliaments, courts, or administrative bodies. Now, this proposal achieves the liberal goal of ensuring that all legally enforceable decisions can be formulated and justified in a universally accessible language without having to restrict the polyphonic diversity of public voices at its very source, namely in civil society and the public sphere. To be sure, the monolingual, if I may say so, contributions of religious citizens then depend on the translational efforts of cooperative fellow citizens if they are not to fall on deaf ears. But religious citizens who regard themselves as loyal members of a constitutional democracy must accept the translation proviso as the price to be paid for the neutrality of the state authority towards competing worldviews and ideological camps. For secular citizens, the same ethics of citizenship entails a complementary burden by the duty of reciprocal accountability to all citizens, including religious ones. They are morally obliged not to publicly dismiss religious contributions to political opinion and will formation as noise or mere nonsense from the outset. Secular and religious citizens must, in their public use of reason, stay at eye level. The contributions of one side supposedly is no less important for a democratic process than those of the other side. Thus, a quite demanding epistemic mindset that cannot be legally imposed is assumed by such an ethics of democratic citizenship. It is assumed on both sides. Whether the expectation associated with this will be fulfilled in fact depends on complementary learning processes. From the religious side, the public use of reason calls for a reflexive consciousness that relates itself to other religions leaves decisions concerning factual, mundane knowledge to the institutionalized sciences and makes the egalitarian premises of the morality of human rights compatible with their own articles of faith, overlapping consensus. On the other hand, the discursive confrontation with religious citizens endowed with equal rights demands from the secular side a similar reflection on the limits of both metaphysical reason, for the insight that vibrant world religions may be bearers of false contents in the sense of suppressed or untapped moral intuitions is by no means a given for the secular portion of the population either. Let me summarize. The concept of the political remains a dubious heritage as long as political theology attempts to preserve its religious connotations for the legitimation of whatever kind of state authority. In view of the fact of pluralism, it is hard to see on which normative grounds the historical step towards a neutral or secularized state authority could be rejected. Less questionable, however, is a revised concept of the political geared to the potentially inspiring contributions of religious communities in the process of democratic legitimation within civil society. The concept is useful for capturing the impact that religion can still have for the self-understanding of all citizens of a secular state. That is my point. As long as religion continues to play a vital role in the informal communication networks of the public sphere, all citizens must be aware of the fact that democratic legitimation in the mode of deliberative politics is supposed to spring from the reciprocal recognition of a mutual interaction between reason-giving religious and non-religious citizens alike. Do I have some more? But then, why should we stick to the pompous concept of the political, given its religious association with the sovereign power, which was, in the meantime, fortunately, disembodied, dispersed, and proceduralized, thus leaving back an empty place at best? The four. I think a revised concept can still fulfill a job as part of a normative political theory which takes the performative view of citizens who respond to the question of what binds them together with their fellow citizens as members of a democratic community. Perhaps it is just this moment of the intentional social integration by political means that is reviving memories of the old usage of the term at a time when the decentering and centrifugal forces of a functional differentiation of society are reaching into the global dimension. In the welfare state, democracies of the latter half of the 20th century, thus under the conditions of embodied capitalism, politics was still able to wield a steering influence on the diverging subsystems and to put a halt into the tendencies toward social disintegration. Politics could succeed in this effort within the framework of the nation state. The political capacities for conspicuously influence social integration are becoming now dangerously restricted under conditions of a globalized capitalism. More than anything else, the erosion of confidence in the communicatively generated power of collective action and the atrophy of normative sensibilities reinforce an already smoldering skepticism concerning the enlightened self-understanding of modernity, mistakenly so, in my opinion, though not completely unjustified. In the waves of a multicultural world society, the secular base of a practical reason common to all constitute the sole, albeit wavering, flank of a deliberative politics as the remaining source of legitimacy. However, the defeatism concerning reason and brooding in secular thought itself, and it inspires doubts over whether the Enlightenment can generate the motives, the motivations for preserving the normative content of modernity out of its own resources. It is these doubts that led me back to the ambivalent concept of the political and lend to the religious connotations of that concept a specific meaning. Non-fundamentalist religious communities can function as a spur in the public use of reason of democratic citizens precisely when the sensibility for normative questions is decaying. Thank you.